Hi, and welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a podcast and video show which brings you role models sharing their leadership lessons, knowledge, and experience from hundreds, no, thousands of successful individuals from around the world. If you're new to the channel, please subscribe so you won't miss a new episode. I'm your host, Fritz Bussemaker, and today I'm delighted and privileged to have a conversation with Treasure Magwanyeze. Treasure, welcome to the program.
Wow. How are you, Fritz? Welcome. Thank you so much for inviting me to your amazing program. I look forward to having a parallel conversation with you and all your listeners who are joining us on this podcast.
Treasure, I can tell you, being a foodie, the pleasure and honor is all mine. Allow me to briefly introduce you. You are the CEO of the Treasure Magwanyeze Restaurant Group.
Right.
You have quite a long growing history of being a chef all over the world, starting in South Africa, up to the Disney Resort in the Bahamas, and now you are in Kigali, Rwanda.
Right.
A long journey into food. What brought you into food in the first place?
Well, thanks and foremost to ask me this amazing question. I think it's quite a big scope of an answer I need to provide to you there. So first and foremost, I think I need to start with my background. You know, obviously my full name is Treasure Magwanyeze. Treasure is my first, no, my second name. And Magwanyeze is my first name, which is my family name. Originally, I'm born and raised from Zimbabwe. I came from a city called Harare, which is the capital of Zimbabwe. I was born in a family of eight. I was the seventh kid, and after me was my young brother. And I have six old siblings that we share the same mom with. So growing up, you know, we grew up in a very disadvantaged community in Zimbabwe. Things were all right because that's the only thing we didn't have any way to compare it. There was no comparison to other lifestyles. So for us being kids, it was okay. But, you know, there was always those forthcoming struggles that will make you see that you're not from a privileged family or background. So we grew up in those kind of backgrounds, and our mom raised us. She was a single mom. She raised us very well. She gave us some, I think, life ethics, you know, the basic things and knowledge of life. I went to school in Zimbabwe, and my mom died when I was around about 14 years. That was a hard moment for me because she was mostly the breadwinner of myself and my siblings. And back then, you know, the economy in Zimbabwe was just going through its hard times and hard moments. So things were really going down in the trenches. And not only me, a lot of us young people, elderly people, were so much forced to leave our country just to seek for better opportunities outside of Zimbabwe. And at the age of 16, thereabouts, I was part of those few people that took a leap of faith to actually leave my country and go outside and see if I could make a better living. So that's when I left Zimbabwe. I was always fascinated as I was growing up. I always wanted to see the ocean. You know, Zimbabwe is a landlocked country. And us being neighbors to South Africa, I knew in Cape Town was the only option I had. So I wanted to always go to Cape Town. And I grew up as a Christian. We used to hear this Bible story about Jonah being swallowed by a fish. So in my mind, I used to ask myself, how big should this fish be, you know, that can swallow a human being for days and the person survive? So I want to go and see a whale, but I can only do that when I go in the ocean. So that was always my inspiration to also go to South Africa. But at that point, it was because of hunger. It was because of ambitious, you know, seeing that, yes, we grew up poor, but there should be something better this life can give, you know, as a result. So I took that leap of faith. I was illegal immigrant. I went without proper documentation to South Africa. I managed to go through the ways, and I was lucky enough to pass the borders. But then the challenge came there, you know, when you cross the border at a young age like that, my mind wasn't set and prepared enough to think that I need a passport, I will need a work permit, I will need even a degree or some sort of certificate or even a CV. I didn't even know that. In my mind was just, once you reach South Africa, your life will change. So when I was there now, you know, reality started to kick in. I ended up finding myself homeless in Johannesburg. I made myself a small side job. Those days, life was very difficult. So I still had this vision. I still need to go to Cape Town because I feel like if I go there, life is going to get better. So as I did, I ended up going to Cape Town with a truck from Johannesburg to Cape Town. That was in early 2009. And when I reached Cape Town, life was even more harder because now Johannesburg is a bit closer to Zimbabwean border, but Cape Town is the furthest part of the Southern Hemisphere. So I didn't have even many Zimbabweans back then. There were few people speaking Shona, a lot of, you know, multicultural, racial people. So it was overwhelming. And there I am finding myself jobless, finding myself homeless. And life was just shambles. And by that time, I didn't even know there's hospitality industry. I didn't know these things existed. I didn't know there's a waiter, there's a chef. And when finally I was lucky enough, one day I got a job at the one and only. And my first job was as a steward, as a cleaner in the kitchen. I didn't have proper documentation that time. The lady who helped me, her name was Christine. I had met her at another hotel. So this is what actually happened. I met Christine at a hotel in Waterfront. It's called Komodo. So I was looking for someone to give me some food as I was very, very hungry. And then I saw this old gentleman sweeping on the foyer of a hotel. So I looked at his face and I assumed he was from Zimbabwe. And instead of speaking English, I said to myself, I'm going to speak Shona. So if he replies me, I would know he's Zimbabwe. So I did as I thought, and he responded. And then, I'm sorry if I'm taking time, but I think you need to hear this part.
Yes, sir.
So I responded, and he responded back in my own language. I felt relieved. I told him my situation, that I was homeless. At that time, I was about 3.5 months to 4 months in the streets. So he told me, look, I'm also sweeping. I can't also help you. But there's a lady who is my manager. She drives a car. Her car is maroon. It's a Chrysler. And she parks her car. He pointed me where she parks her car. So he told me, but I would advise you, the way you are looking, if the security sees you around, they're going to chase you. So maybe go in the main road. Once you see that car with this description, you can just come back. So I did as he said. Sincerely, the car came after like some time. I approached this car as if I was almost going to do a robbery. But then I knelt down. You know, I was very dirty, and most of the time, you know, you've seen street kids in the streets. Sometimes they can be intimidating. You don't really know what they're going to do. You know, I was really that dirty. And for any normal person to not fear, it would have been lucky. So I wanted her to be comfortable. So I knelt down to show her that I didn't mean any harm. So when I knelt down and she's coming from her car, she saw this young boy kneeling down, and she just kept her files on her hands like this. I started explaining myself to this lady. I told her everything, how I had transited from Zimbabwe to South Africa, how I'm in that moment. And she didn't say a word. It was surprisingly, because normally once you see the appearance of a person, you can easily chase them away. No, I'm busy, you know. It didn't happen that way. And at the end of my explanatory, I told her, I remember vividly that I told her that before you make any decision, whatever answer you're going to give me is going to either make my life or make my life into more worse. So she took a deep breath, and the first thing she asked me, show me your passport. There we go, I don't have a passport. She asked me, where's your permit? I don't have a permit. Do you have an asylum? I didn't even know what an asylum was. So she asked me, how can I help you? You don't have any proper documentation for working. And that was my first time I actually knew now you need these things to work. All along, I thought you're just going to go in a company and get employed. So she even directed me to Home Affairs, which was helping some foreigners to acquire for asylum. Before I left, I asked her one question. I said to her, please promise me if I bring this paper, you're going to give me a job. And she said, I promise. So I left. I went to this Home Affairs where she described me. Unfortunately, it was just difficult to get this paper because there were so many illegal immigrants that time in South Africa, and the corruption of these immigrants and Home Affairs officers was just getting crazy. So it took me a good 2 weeks to actually get this paper since the day I had met this lady, and I haven't met her again. I didn't even know her name. I didn't know the gentleman name who I had met. So now the only thing I have, I'm just hopeful. And all, you know, sometimes being young, I always tell people being young sometimes is the best thing because we don't calculate risks as we do when we grow up. Because if it would have happened by today, I wouldn't have gone back after 2 weeks. If somebody promised me a job, 2 weeks later going out, they've just assumed there's no more need to go. It's already too late. So I kept the faith. I finally get this paper, went back to look for this lady. She wasn't working at Komodo anymore, but I didn't know that. I'm looking for the gentleman who was sweeping. I can't see him. I can't find the car in the parking lot. So it took me 3 days being stationed in that same vicinity, trying to see these people. And on the third day, I met this guy who I had met first time, and he told me, unfortunately, Christine, that was her name, she doesn't work here anymore. And I was so disappointed. And he told me, but don't worry, she just works on that resort just behind Komodo. That's where One and Only was. And One and Only was being set up for their pre-opening in 2009. So he explained to me how to go there. I went there. I looked in the parking and I saw the car. As I saw the car, I remember the car and I said, oh yeah, thank God. So I sat in the parking lot. This was whole day. I was waiting for her, and then she finally came around 5 p.m. She was going home. But then when I saw her approaching the parking lot, I went back to her. I walked towards her and she remembered me. So about 5 meters to 10 meters away, she was like, you. And she was holding a box again of files. I'm assuming she was busy with their office setting up. So I offered her help. I helped her carry her box. And she asked me, what took you so long? I explained to her, it was just difficult to get this paper. And then she told me, look, I promised to give you a job. I'm going to live up to my promise. But all the positions I wanted to give you, they are all filled up. But because I promise you, I'm going to give you a 2 week job, which for me, that was good enough. All I wanted was to secure a job, get money, go back to Zimbabwe. Because yes, we were struggling, but I wasn't living in the streets. You know, I wasn't a street person. We had still a home. So she gave me a job as a kitchen steward for 2 weeks. And that time when One and Only was opening, it was said to be the first six-star resort in Africa. There was Gordon Ramsay, Nobu, Chef Nobu from Japan. There were all these, well-experienced people applying to work at this master plan, iconic resort, you know. So the competition in terms of people who were working there was so high because you could find some head chefs in some hotels, were applying jobs to come and work there as sous chefs or as chef de, just to get the experience to work with Gordon Ramsay. Everyone wanted that. So I found myself in the kitchen as a steward. That was my first time entering a kitchen, and the very, very first time when I when those big doors opened, I'm seeing people wearing white hats, white uniform. They're moving like ants, you know. It's white walls and everything is bright. I was so like, you know, it was so much to absorb. And the pressure that comes with it, but you just have to keep cleaning, washing dishes. They show me how to do everything. And, you know, so the thing is that many people didn't know my story, that I wasn't having a stable life. And this lady, she also did very well. She quite kept it to herself. At the resort, we used to have staff lockers, showers. We would be given lunch meals, breakfast meals, depending on your shift. So I used to work from 7 p.m. to 2 p.m., from 7 a.m. to 2 p.m. It used to be my shift. But because I didn't have a place to go, I would always offer myself to do overtime. And because the hotel was busy, they always wanted people to work extra.
Yeah.
But most people, they had families, so they always refused to work overtime. They wanted to go home. But for me, I looked at it as an opportunity, one, to increase my hours because I only had 2 weeks. So the more I work, the hopefully the more I get paid. Yeah. And secondly, I was feeling safe to being at a hotel. I'm eating free food. I'm in an enclosed space. I don't have to go out and sleep outside. So I worked double shift on every day of my 2 weeks. But people who didn't know my story, they thought this guy is a hard worker. You know, he's working double every day. He comes to work first time. He's the first person to arrive. He's the last person to leave. You know, they call me in the office 2 days before my 2 weeks was finished. And they told me, look, we're going to make you a permanent. The chefs, they like working with you. Everyone thinks you're a great person. So we're going to give you a permanent job. That was my happy moment. I said, wow, this is good. So from there, I started setting myself, looking for a house in some of the low respected areas in South Africa, which are quite dangerous, but very affordable. Many people live there, many Black people and foreigners. So life started changing from there. But now I'm permanent. I'm no longer getting paid overtime. All the hours doesn't count. But at home, I have nobody. Still, I can't rush to go home. So I started offering my services to chefs. You know, instead of me going home after my normal shift, I would offer them, can I peel this? And I tell you what, all chefs, we are very lazy. The more skilled you become, the less you get. Because the reason why I'm saying that, no chef wants to go home smelling onions and garlic. If you can find someone to do it for you, you're always going to give them that. So they will give you loads of garlic, loads of onion. Sometimes you go home, your eyelids are swollen up, you know, from peeling onion. But that's when I started learning slowly. And it was just about 3 months I did that route. And they came to me, one of the guys, his name was Jason Miller. He was a white guy from Zimbabwe. And he came to me and he told me, you're going to be a great chef one day. And me, I'm like, I don't even know what this guy is telling me about.
Yeah. Tricia, did you actually ask him why he thought that? Did you ask him, why do you make that statement?
No, actually, I didn't. You see, you're talking with a kid who has never been in this industry. The only thing that is exciting me is the pressure that's coming from other chefs. They are being yelled at. You know, they're using F words and some real guys are crying. It's like an I'm seeing that there's so much love and passion you have to do. And guess what? In my own context of eating, it's not making sense because I grew up eating same thing every day. So now why are these people really fighting for food? And because the kitchen was behind, it wasn't an open kitchen, I couldn't see the people eating this food, right? So in my mind, I'm saying, who is these people eating this food? Why are these people killing each other for people? You know, like, it didn't make sense. But the adrenaline that came with it, you know, the speed that came, it was just, for me, was captivating. And seeing a chef chopping fast, you know, sometimes I'll be mopping, right? Then I look to the side and I see a chef and he's busy concentrating. He doesn't know that there's this kid admiring him, staring at him. You know, that's where the passion and the love came. You know, that's why even today, I always have a philosophy to my team that whatever we do at work, you are always on stage. You know, it could be even holding an onion, a carrot. You don't know who is watching you. You know, somebody might be watching you to feel inspired. But if you don't show love, if you're not focused, people will not be interested in that industry. So for me, those are the things that really made me fell in love in cooking. I said, wow, this job is about love. And I grew up being raised that men don't cook. You know, it's a women job. But now I'm seeing big guys, tall, masculine guys doing this. I was like, wow, this is a dream job. So that's when I started wanting to become a chef. And when Jason Miller gave me that opportunity, I didn't look back. I took it with both hands and with my heart. I started learning at the beginning. You know, when the delivery comes, they used to make me pack the fridge. So at the beginning, it was more like chefs, some elderly chefs are becoming lazy. But it taught me to remember the names of the herbs. I guess I didn't go to culinary school. I didn't know it. So that's where I started actually learning faster than what I would have done. Packing the dry store, knowing, oh, these are spices, this. And sometimes when I get paid, my mentor was a very good guy. I always give him credit. He told me one thing that I always care with. He said, you are having a job, and your job, you need to always invest in your job every month. When you get your salary, no matter how small it is, you need to put a portion of it in investing. Either you buy a peeler, either it's a small spoon, either it's a small soup book with 5 recipes, whatever. Just buy something. So I used to do that. I would buy some cookbooks. When I'm reading, I see some words, sauté, or flambé, or lemongrass, things that I would not know, I would write down. When I go back to work, I would ask, what is lemongrass? Because I knew lemon only, I didn't know there's a grass. So in my mind, I'll be like, there's a grass in a lemon. What do they mean? So when I go to work, so these things, they made me learn faster. And, you know, the passion grew and grew, and I became a chef at One and Only. And One and Only also really gave me that lifetime opportunity, which I'll never get anywhere else. And I always think I was there at the right time. The amount of talented people who were around me was just amazing. And also, as I said, that day when we met at YPO, I grew up knowing white people were devils. You guys, I didn't even believe in you. That was my traditions. I grew up from that type of tradition. But when I was in South Africa, the black people were the ones doing xenophobic attacks, xenophobic remarks. They were being racial against me. Yet this white person sees me, I'm black, he's giving me a lifetime opportunity, he's mentoring me, what have I done to deserve? So I started questioning myself a lot about race. So I came to a conclusion that, you know, race is actually an illusion. There is no race. It's our thoughts, it's our mindsets that are racist, but we might look white, we might look black, but we are all the same. Because it changed the whole thought I had, and it helped me to understand that sometimes life is not what you are presented, but what you have experienced yourself as a human being. So I started to love every type of people, white people, you know, black people, and it helped me to open up my mindset. I started learning cooking. I became better with what I did. I won two cooking competitions within 2 months consecutive. There was internal competition at One and Only for young chefs, for junior chefs. So I ended up winning a scholarship to go and actually study. So I was the first person, one and only, has ever paid for scholarship. And after me, they started actually introducing it as a program to take some few people, help them study. And so it took me about 4.5 years working at One and Only, absorbing, just being a sponge, absorbing all the skills, the right techniques, love, the passion. And I later resigned. But before I did that, of course, I took a vacation. On my fourth year completing in South Africa, heaven, went back home. I went back home for the first time with some furniture that I had bought. People were happy. You know, I went some groceries. You know, my family was happy to see me, that I was healthy and alive. And then I went to apply for a passport. So when I went back, I started to fix my paperwork, and then I became legal. And then I started looking jobs abroad. But there's always that mindset in you that reminds you, no, you're not good enough. This is not who you are. You think you're going to get a job overseas? No. There was always that hold back. But I was lucky enough. I got my first job in Abu Dhabi at a hotel called, that time it used to be called Yas Viceroy. And it's located next to F1, Formula One. And it's built in such a way that there is a race course that passes between this hotel. So it was a beautiful transition from working from an iconic resort to also go to work in one of the iconic resorts too. So the standard kept, you know, going same or even higher. So my skill set didn't drop. From there, it was a lot to absorb. My first time in overseas, I didn't like it, to be honest. Middle East back then, there were too many rules. I felt like I was so much used to South African lifestyle. So I resigned. I went back to South Africa. And that time I got a job to work at MediClinic in Hope Street, Cape Town. I was a head chef. It was ran by this other catering called WPC. So I didn't like this job, but the money was great. But for me, I'm passionate. Now I have to cater for people who are sick. There's pediatric ward, there's this, there's that. It was just so much. And funny enough, my next job was for Disney Cruise Liners. I worked for Disney Magic, yeah. So one of the key requirements actually is to know the dietary requirements, of which I had learned it at a hospital where I hated it. So at some point, I've learned it also in life that sometimes moments that we hate the most, there's always a skill. There's that always, one day.
Mm, there's always a purpose. There's always a reason behind that.
Mm.
I am a mesmerized treasure just listening to your life story. May I ask you maybe to make a segue to Rwanda, because that's where we met.
Yes, yes. So
how did you end up in Rwanda? How did that came about?
Great. So years later, after I've acquired experience in different countries, I remember in 2016, I was working in Seychelles at Frigate Private Island. I tried to apply back to One and Only via emails as a sous chef, but I was thinking it's impossible. So they didn't respond my emails. But surprisingly, my mentor, Coach Jason Miller, that time he had also left One and Only. So in 2017, they called him back to become an executive chef of One and Only Cape Town. So he was trying to strengthen up the team. So we were in touch with him, me and him. So he offered me a job. He told me, come and run one of the restaurants as a chef de cuisine or a sous chef. So I was like, wow, this is amazing. Let me come. So I dropped whatever I was doing. I went to One and Only Cape Town in 2017. And that time, One and Only was busy setting up Rwanda. And I only worked there for 2 months. Before my 2 months, no, after my 2 months, I got an invitation to the office. I was given a promotion with the executives of One and Only that I should come to Rwanda as an executive chef to come and open a new resort. So in my mind, I was very overwhelmed, and I didn't know if I would be able to do it because obviously computer skills, you know, costings, there's a lot of admin part I didn't know. I was just a good cook, but now you have to be a good manager. And that's when I took the risk. I came to Rwanda in 2017. And my first day, I had a horrible day in Rwanda. When I came, my bag with my knives was missing. And I was worried because I collected it for so many years. I felt like I lost something. But then one day after it came, as well, the day I arrived, as I was driving to One and Only Nyungwe, passing through a market called Nyabugogo, where there's so many people, it's crowded. I didn't like it. I felt like I'm coming to a village. So I really felt like I did a very bad career decision. But when I reached Nyungwe, seeing greenery, I love forest, I love vegetation, I start to, you know, feel in love again with the space. And the way they welcomed me at One and Only made me feel very special. But there was a big challenge about the things I had to achieve. I'm opening a resort, meaning the budgets of positions, setting up the kitchen, all these things. Yes, I was being supported by global office, but I had to have these skills. And
yeah. Okay. Treasures, so far you've given me a great overview of your life, coming out of extreme poverty and pulling yourself up, becoming a chef, traveling the world. Now, I would say the easy and maybe selfish route to take is trying to aim to be the best chef in the world and leading a team. But what amazed me when we met in Rwanda, in Kigali, you actually also use the position you have to allow also young kids to follow the same path you are following. So picking people up from the street, giving them a job.
Right.
That sounds like a decision you needed. Is it, can you combine that, being the best chef in the world and helping underprivileged kids? Or is it a compromise? Or is it, how do you combine those two ambitions?
For me, what I chase, I don't chase being the best chef in the world because I will never be one. There's many talented chefs around, I think, but I always seek to connect with my clients emotionally when they eat the food, because food is big, food is massive. And on top of that, I'm a true testimony that hospitality is something one can just be trained to. As long as they are passionate and willing and they have enough time, anyone can be successful to become any good cook or any good restaurant manager. So that's what inspires me. I look around the statistics of people in Africa or in the world in general and say, you know what, we're having so many institutions around the world. When they are listing for their job vacancies, they have many requirements. They always ask minimum of this, minimum of that. So for my thought, I always say, so what about those people who were like me plus 15 years ago, we wouldn't have gotten these opportunities, right? But yet look at myself, I didn't have all these minimum requirements they asked for, but I actually became one of the people who took it serious. So I believe that there's always someone out there who is not getting any opportunity and who is ready and willing. So those are the people I try to seek for. Those, I don't focus on people who came from universities, because I know they already have options. Yeah. They can be heard, they can be given even an interview appointment. So I always focus on those who are hopeless, those who are thinking there's no other means, and bring them to this industry, show them that, look, there's so many things we can all do. From cleaning, you can either end up as a F&B manager, CEO, or a sommelier, or a chef. So come, let's give you a basic. So that's my motive. I always feel happy when I work with people who have no experience at all, show them how to fish so that they can be able to be their own bosses. And I'm very happy to tell you that so far in Rwanda, there's quite a lot of places that even if I walk there today, I can find a head chef, used to be my cleaner, maybe my their supervisor used to be my trainee. You know, all these things inspires me. And that combined now, when you connect with your people, with your clients who eat your food, is the best reward that I can ever get in this industry. You know, that's, I think, my summary. I can say that's the feel that I look for while I do these things.
Treasure, in your story, you've already covered so much answers to questions I did not need to ask. So I want to thank you so much for sharing your story so far. Given the time, unfortunately, I'd like to end with one question. What would your advice be to those young people out there listening to your story?
I'd advise them that there's no end. The sky is not the limit. Because if you tell people the sky is the limit, Elon Musk will laugh at us. Richard Branson will laugh at us, because they've passed through the sky and they came back. So, you know, your mind is your limit. Belief is out there. Keep looking for it. When you find it, treasure it, cherish it, take love into it, and don't chase money. You know, money is not a skill. You can become broke if you don't have a skill, even if you have money. So always look for skills and be nice to people, inspire people, be the change that you want to see. And one last thing I always say to people is that life is a chain. When you are blessed or you are given help, you have to recreate two more helps that you give others. So that's the only thing I have to say for now. And for also maybe your other viewers who are there to support this kind, we still very much have a big ambition to grow, to develop in business. We're looking for people who have, financial strengths.
Our interview?
No problem.
I really want to thank you so much for your time right now. Actually, I'd like to see if we can revisit the dialogue, because I'd like to talk about African food culture.
Right.
But in any case, for now, thank you so much for sharing your life story from where you came to where you are right now.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.